It's Friday and time to welcome in the weekend. I'm Anne Strange-Hamps, and today on 45 North, one of the big weekend events is the Wisconsin Science Festival, going on in Madison and around the state. It's a statewide celebration whose theme is Curiosity Unleashed. We're bringing you some of the best of the Science Festival right here this morning, beginning with Nobel Prize-winning chemist. He's also a poet and playwright, Roald Hoffman. He's here in the studio with us, along with artist Vivian Torrance, and we're going to talk with them about their Chemistry Imagined project, which is a science and art collaboration. Roald and Vivian, thank you so much for being here, and welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you, Anne.
So traditionally we think of art and chemistry, art and science, as two different things, two different spheres, and you have both in different ways worked to break down that division. Roald, how much art is there in chemistry?
Well, there is a good bit of art in several different ways. There is, of course, the art, the skill and ingenuity and imagination in making molecules or finding out what they are. But there is also simple beauty in the molecules themselves, both in their external appearance, the colors of substances and crystals, even in the smokes, bangs, and stinks of chemical transformation. Actually, that's the most interesting thing about chemistry is chemistry's about change. It's about A plus B going to C plus D, and that going to, represented by an arrow, is really an essential transformation. And that is something that's inherently artistic.
Yeah, I was going to say, Vivian, is that the science that's hidden in art, the science of transformation?
Well, it is in this particular project for me. I think there's if you go back to alchemical times, the alchemist was the person who was going to change lead into gold, and that transformation became metaphorical for life changes. And as life changes, then so does you become something new. So the idea of bringing two things together and winding up with a third thing is an important aspect. Not so much in the tangible aspects of chemicals in art as a technical aspect, but more in the actual process of entering into making something in art. You wind up transforming yourself. You become something else.
So, well, they're both about making, aren't they?
Yes.
An artist takes canvas, yes, paint, and makes something brand new, and a chemist takes what? Atoms? And creates a new molecule.
Well, we take molecules and make new molecules from them, which is also interesting because, so atoms are fun. Atoms are great. Atoms are really the building blocks of this world, but the world is made out of molecules, not atoms. So molecules are persistent groupings of atoms. The atoms are like the Lego blocks. The molecules are what your kid makes with them, which is more interesting, I think, than the molecules. Now, you can see all this metaphor coming through. I mean, chemistry is about molecules being changed to other molecules. I'm eating a bagel. That bagel is going to get digested. Yes, that's biology, but that's going on chemical, and that's why if I eat too much, you have to take an antacid, which is another chemical. Anyway, it's going to get transformed. It's going to get broken down in my body and built up by the internal chemical machines I have into other molecules. What's going to happen is bonds are going to be broken, and bonds are going to be made. There's a lot of metaphor there.
I always love talking with scientists. I mean, I'm somebody with no training in science, but I love trying to see the world through a different set of eyes. Just listening to you talk, I suddenly get this idea that the entire world, everything we see around us, really is made of chemistry, of chemicals, isn't it?
It is. It is made. Everything around here. And incidentally, that includes everything artifactual, everything that we have as human beings made. It's made from something. At the beginning is something natural. if you were to count our actions as nature too, then everything in this world is artifactual. Nylon as well as cotton.
Well, that's interesting because we tend to think, no, there are these artificial things that humans make and that we sort of pollute the world with, and then they're the good natural things that existed from the very beginning.
I think everything has natural origins. It's just a question of where they begin. Let's talk about nylon, cotton, and rayon.
Okay?
Uh-huh. So everyone thinks cotton is natural, and everyone thinks nylon is artificial, synthetic, man or woman made.
Mm-hmm. In some laboratory somewhere.
Unnatural. And most people don't know what rayon is. But rayon is actually cotton or some other cellulose. It used to be wool pickers, used to get rag pickers. And that cellulose today from trees is transformed into rayon. Okay, each of those comes originally from a plant source. The tree that grew once, that became oil, petroleum, that was then harvested from oil wells and then transformed by human action into the chemicals that make nylon. Cotton and the tree that became rayon eventually are obviously had a seed. Rather interesting, cotton is the most heavily agrochemical crop there is.
And you're breaking down all our distinctions.
I want to break you down. I want you to think that everything has natural origins. And of those three, the seed that eventually led through human action and natural action to nylon, that seed that led to nylon is the only one of the three compared to the cotton and the wood that was planted to make the rayon eventually. That's the only seed that was untouched by human beings.
So you could argue that nylon is, in fact, the most natural of the three.
I don't want to break down the distinction too much. Mm. I think one has to worry about the distance of the transformation, how much energy is expended in the transformation, how much energy is wasted in making the nylon compared to making the cotton. And also one has to worry about the ethics of the transformation.
Sure. But metaphorically, the interesting thing that you're doing is talking about breaking down the divisions, the distinctions that we make. This, in some ways, what's artificial are the distinctions that we make, which is what we're talking about with the two of you, a scientist and an artist. Vivian, tell us how did this Chemistry Imagined project, well, first of all, what is it, and how did you guys come up with it?
This is because Roald and I met at an unusual place. It was an artist residency program that Carl Durassi founded.
Another great chemist.
And he liked to bring artists of different sorts together. So there are choreographers and composers and writers and visual artists like myself. Just entering into that community for a month with nothing else in distraction, we're very far out in the country, puts a lot of different influences into your life. You tend to start thinking about how does music really affect you? Do you want to listen to music while you're working, or is it a distraction? For me, music was always a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're working in the studio, you have a very sealed-off world, and you can get pretty hermitized by that. And so one of the things that seems to happen to me all the time is I get into a conversation with someone, and this time it was Roald, and we tell a story this evening at our talk that I won't give away now. But when we started talking, he could see that my work has images in it, and they're narrative. They usually try to tell a story. There are figures in them and numbers. And he saw that as having something to do with science. And so he did ask me about what I knew about science.
Well, so you wound up with this project, which is the text is Carl's Rold's musings, poetry, small essays, and the images are your half paintings, half collages, right? You work, kind of work with both media.
The collages are pieced together, very puzzle-like. They're faceted pieces of paper. They're not like one on top of the other. They're very precisely placed next to each other. So in the end, although you can still see the cut works, which is a formal element of the painting, they seal a single surface and present a narrative that is what is what the story is in that particular picture.
Well, I want to ask you both about, and to give an example in a minute, but first I want to put a question out to listeners. What do you think about bringing science and art together? Are you a scientist who makes art, an artist who loves science, and where do you find the common ground between the two? You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us. That's the address is WPR.org/talk. And we do have one caller on the line. Let's go to Rose in Milwaukee. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, did you have a question or a comment?
I have a comment, and it's also somewhat of a question. And that is the difference between art and science in today's society is that art is an individual expression, and science has been co-opted by industry so that it doesn't necessarily serve what the needs of the people or the earth are, but rather the profits of a particular industry. And if we can separate that and we can begin to think of science as serving the future and serving humanity, I can see the marriage between the two.
Hmm. Well, this is Roald. Just to answer a little bit of that, your assumption is that science is done or collected by industry. I don't know. That's technology and industrial practice, but science is done by me has very little to do with industry. Let me put it another way. I don't have a single patent. On some criteria, I'm useless in that sense. But I definitely think that we should worry about the uses to which our science is put. But I think it's also I think the use is something separate. I will say something about collective and individual. I see it another way. All my papers, my scientific papers, the useless ones, are written by 2, 3, or 4 people. We have mastered in science the ethic of collaboration.
I'm curious, going back to that individual versus, you know, the large lab full of people, and something that I guess I didn't know about before I began reading some of the things that you've written, Roald, is how much work goes into creating an individual molecule. And also, I must be very stupid, I didn't realize how many people are actively creating molecules all the time, new molecules.
Yes.
Yeah.
There are millions of them. In fact, chemists have added to this world some 70 million new molecules since in 200 years of frenetic activity.
70 million.
70
That's
million.
Astonishing. You describe, did I get this right? Do you actually go into the library from time to time to kind of catch up on the new molecules?
I do.
How do you do that?
Not all the time. Well, I used to go into a real library. There no longer are real libraries, even for us. But on the web, I subscribe like anyone else to an RSS feed or something, and I get every week 1,500 articles to read that I don't read carefully. I look through them. I look through the abstracts. I read carefully, maybe 10. But there are lots of molecules. I don't want to evade the implication of the listener's question that we should worry about the utility of the molecules and I think scientists sometimes don't do too well at that. But I think we do create things. That's the special thing about chemistry. We really make these molecules in the same way that artists make them, in the same way that engineers build bridges.
Right. Well, and so circling back to that question about beauty that we wanted to explore, you know, if you're looking at a new molecule, you read a paper and somebody's created a new molecule, is there part of you that thinks that's beautiful, or is there part of you that thinks that one's kind of ugly?
Yeah, I don't know if there are any ugly ones. My general feeling about ugly molecules is that I probably haven't looked hard enough to find out what's beautiful about it. But yes, I do that. Sometimes I'm jealous that they've made it.
And then what makes a molecule beautiful?
A few things. The most obvious thing that makes it beautiful, that has a beeline into our soul, is symmetry. And complexity is much more difficult, but that's true of art too, yeah, wouldn't you say, Vivian?
Yes, it is. One of the things I think that struck a chord between us is that at the time, everybody was reducing things. It was a reductionist time. Everybody was trying to make things simple, get it back down to fundamental, you know, less is more. Mm-hmm. And I don't see it that way, and Roel didn't see it that way. We wanted to explore the idea of what's complex. How do you make it more things happening, mm-hmm. and still come out in the end with a unified either work of collaboration like we did, or for me personally, in the work of art. So I'd love to jam all kinds of stuff in my pictures. There's one of them called Chemical Arts, has 56 different figures from different pages of a book, and they're engravings stuck together, and then tried to resolve the space among all those. So,
well, that's what's beautiful, isn't it? When you can get all that complexity and make it work together.
It can be ordered.
Have order there at the same time.
Yeah.
Sometimes beauty is gained not necessarily by what the thing is, but by where it's going. So in chemistry, one is making a complex molecule, and one builds up a certain function. The molecule that's in the middle in that function, that may be looking like a construction site for a house, or a building, a beautiful building. I'm sure that Gary's Bilbao Museum, when it was being built, looked like a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So some molecules look like a mess when they're built. They look like princes, like frogs about to be kissed. That is, they don't look like the prince that's going to come out of this. Mm-hmm. And that's fun.
Well, you guys did, I know you've talked about hemoglobin, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
Basic molecule courses through all of us. What does it look like?
Oh, it looks like a clump of pasta congealed from primordial soup. It looks like a tapeworm quadrille. It's got 9,500 atoms. And yes, the action takes place at just four of them. Four iron atoms, which bind the oxygen, but there's incredible complexity around that, which allows that molecule's function to pick up oxygen in the lungs and then to deliver it to another complicated molecule, myoglobin, in the muscle cells. All that complexity is there for a reason, to provide function.
And it's also beautiful. We're talking this morning with Roald Hoffman, who has been called an especially complex molecule himself. He is a Nobel Prize-winning chemist who once dreamed of being an art historian. He began to write poetry at age 40, plays after age 60. He's in Wisconsin this weekend for Wisconsin's Science Festival, along with artist Vivian Torrance, and they'll be talking about their Chemistry Imagined project at the Wisconsin Science Festival tonight. Wisconsin Public Radio's Steve Paulson will lead a discussion afterwards. And if you are in Madison, you can also see the paintings and collages we're talking about. Vivian's work is on exhibition at the Union South Gallery on the UW-Madison campus. For details about all of it, the talk, the paintings, everything, visit our Facebook page, 45 North on WPR. And when we come back, what do you think about bringing science and art together? Are you a scientist who makes art, an artist who loves science? Where do you find the common ground between the two? You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email us, wpr.org/talk, here on 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Anne Strange-Hampson. You're listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Nobel Prize-winning chemist Roald Hoffman and artist Vivian Torrence about their joint project, Chemistry Imagined. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Where do you find the common ground between science and the arts? And we've got a caller on the line, Camille from Frankfurt. Hi, Camille.
I have to say, there is not a subject that is closer to my heart and the way I try to live than the science of art and the art of science. I have been attracted to both so much so that when I was in college, I had a very hard time choosing what to do. And I was really happy later in my life to discover the work of Goethe because he was such a disciplined observer of nature and an artist at the same time with his poetry. And I feel that if there's any way to heal the rift between the two, it would do us all a lot of good. I wonder if your guests feel that they're on the way to doing something like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have some personal experience in, you talked about that rift between science and art? I mean, where do you see that?
Well. There are a lot of ways. A lot of it has to do with being in the eye of the beholder. But I'll tell you one simple way, and that is as a teacher of young children and also in the realm of trying to heal illness, there are ways in which art and science together affect each other. And you can see that if you study plants and their properties, if you study the way a child develops and the kinds of things that they need at various windows of their development, the one affects the other in the body, in the organism, and it affects each. They affect each other in your soul, in your spirit. It's kind of hard to speak about in concrete terms, but it is my experience.
Thank you so much for the call. Roald, does that spark any thoughts for you?
Yes, I think, of course, we share in this desire to bring the two fields together, art and science. It's quite natural that we bring the two, that we think about what is beautiful in the science that they do. It's true there may be barriers to that we need to know the knowledge, and we need to know the details of the knowledge sometimes to appreciate the beauty of something. But we can be brought to that by someone who tells us about the chords in music and what is the difference between a major and a minor chord and how they combine with each other, as was done in a program that we had. And science can be taught so that people can appreciate both the ingenuity in making a molecule and also in thinking up new molecules. The two need to be brought together.
Mm. Vivian, any thoughts?
Yes, I could just say the opposite almost right now, because I could say, well, science is science and art is art. I mean, they are not the same thing, but that doesn't mean one can't bring them together, because somewhere the connection is made between mind and spirit, which is exactly what your caller, Camille, was talking
right
about.
Well, and of course, there is there is science in art, and there is art in science. Roald, we were talking about the, you know, the beauty you can perceive in some molecules. Of course, everything artists work with is made of chemicals. I mean, Roald, I think I saw somewhere, didn't you give a lecture or a talk recently about indigo?
Yes, and I'm going to give the talk again at Beth Israel Community Center here in Madison on Saturday evening at 8. People are welcome. I mean, there is an element, indigo, but more generally, dyes and color, which has just interested people throughout history. And I'm going to talk about indigo 1 from snails, which is the Tyrian purple, but also served the Hebrews in biblical times to color a fringe in a ritual garment that they wore. That indigo also comes from plant sources and became generally available. And today it comes in chemicals that are used. There are about 2 billion pairs of blue jeans made every year, mostly in China. It takes 2 to 3 grams of indigo to color each pair of blue jeans. Someone has estimated that if all the blue jeans in the world were made from plant indigo, the world would be covered with 10 feet of indigo plants. So everyone, young people and old, should be grateful for chemistry for providing blue jeans for everybody.
No place for corn or soybeans then.
Well, yes. No place for soybeans.
We'd all be eating our blue jeans. I will think about that next time I put on a pair of jeans. Let's go next to Nick in Minneapolis. Hi, Nick.
Hi. I see a fundamental connection between art and science, specifically in the work that I do as an art therapist and professor, in my work with people that have medical, mental illness, and mental health issues. And specifically with people that have Alzheimer's and dementia, there are visual perceptual deficits in the brain that are caused by atrophy in brain cells. And with that atrophy, people that have Alzheimer's and dementia actually perceive color and form differently.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yes, they may misname things or misperceive objects. There are difficulty in distinguishing between pastel colors, for instance, and other types of forms.
What do you do as an artist then with that?
So I create paintings, drawings, and sculptures with my patients, and I reduce the forms to basic geometric shapes to reacclimate them to their world because of the visual perceptual problems they do have. For instance, they may even see things that we don't see. They may perceive colors as another color, blue as red, or they may just see things as invisible. So it's really about reducing forms down to shapes.
Hmm.
That's very interesting. Do you find that the connection of shape with color or object is important? So what I'm thinking about is that the visual tactile link, is it important for your patients that they touch the object with their hands? Does that help them?
It helps them to touch the object, and especially if it's a three-dimensional sculpture, it helps orient them to time and place. And especially with the colors, to be able to verbalize and to minimize the amount of choices I give them actually helps them to better orient themselves. And I also approach this with a Bauhaus style, so that I will sometimes place certain lines on the paper, and it goes back to the Bauhaus in Germany in the early 1900s, so that I'm not just giving them a blank page or a blank canvas, I'm creating some kind of structure for them.
That's interesting as it relates to art, because when you start teaching drawing, one of the first things that I would say to the students is, okay, you have a piece of paper in front of you. It's important that you stay parallel and perpendicular to it, to keep the parallels and perpendiculars right, because we perceive a piece of paper as a reflection of ourselves. We're the vertical line, our hands outstretched are the horizontal, and that represents horizontal and uprightness in moving through space. So I can, and that's the simplest beginning for a drawing student. To add the complexity and add more and more onto it becomes quite confusing, so you just do it step by step so that they understand what space is in two-dimension.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. You're already, again, the similarities between chemistry. Yes. You're talking about orientation in space.
Yes, and what we do in organic chemistry courses, we have students build models of molecules, and then we also invent a simple sign structure on paper. So here is this community of chemists. Molecules are three-dimensional. It's essential to communicate that three-dimensionality to each other. But they're not talented at drawing. They're
really
not selected to be good chemists on a basis of their ability to draw. My ability to draw a human face atrophied at age 6. I didn't get good instruction.
Do you think you'd do better chemistry if you were a better artist?
I think it would help, but actually we can teach every chemist. We do that in a organic chemistry course through this handling of the models and a simple visual language on a piece of paper. A wedge means coming in front, and a dashed line means coming in back of the plane of the paper, and a solid line means in the plane of the paper. And if they draw that while handling the model, forever the three-dimensionality is imprinted, even in the simplest visual code.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's so like what Nick was saying. Nick,
yes,
thanks, by the way.
Why.
Thank you for joining us. And we've got another caller on the line. Let's go to Karen in Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi, Karen.
Good morning. I am loving this program.
Thanks.
I have three grandchildren. My granddaughter is 11, and my two grandsons are 9 and 7. And they love science, and they love all kinds of art, and we talk often, we spend a lot of time outside, and we talk often about the world is not divided into science and art and other kinds of things. We just use those glasses when we look at things to help us understand parts of those things.
Yeah.
So a tree doesn't have a sign on it that says, I'm part of science. A tree is part of science and part of art and all kinds of other things. And my granddaughter writes wonderful poetry for an 11-year-old about the natural world. And my 9-year-old grandson just is a very astute observer and a wonderful artist and scientist. And just the other day, we were going from a parking lot into a building, and he bent down, and we saw a brand new kind of caterpillar, extremely beautiful. He talked about the colors of the caterpillar. He talked about the size, and I said, shall we move it over so it doesn't get run over? And he said, yes, we should, but as he bent down, he said, oh, it might be poison. It's a kind we don't know. And then my younger grandson loves to cook. And we cook a lot together. And when we cook, I always say to him, cooking, remember, is part chemistry and part art and part love. And I am enjoying this program, which is science
thank
and
you.
Art and love of both. And thank you so much to all
of
you.
Karen, you have very lucky grandchildren.
Yes, yes, I think so, too.
Yeah, oh, that's true. You know, so one question I have, Roald, is for all that you're talking about beauty, I have the sense that it's something that scientists may talk about to each other or with non-scientists, but I'm not sure you'd put anything about beauty in a scientific paper.
That's true, and there's a loss there to us. The language of science, for what were good reasons when it developed in the 19th century, dealt out expressions of emotional expressions, expressions of quality opinions, and tried to report all the facts that could be verified by other people. But it lost something in the process because it's human beings who deal with those facts. And now, 200 years down the line after the origin of that article, we have a dry product whose insensitivity to human emotion makes people think that the people who do it have no emotions. Mm-hmm. But they do. I think nothing would be lost if we introduced a little more personal, colorful language into the scientific article. What we teach our students, graduate students now, in a research group is how to tell good science from routine science. And they would not be fooled by colorful language in a scientific article. I think we should relax.
Hmm. We're talking with Roald Hoffman. He's a Nobel Prize-winning chemist, also a poet and a playwright. And we're also talking with Vivian Torrance, an artist. They are in Wisconsin for this weekend's Science Festival. They'll be talking about their Chemistry Imagined project at the Wisconsin Science Festival tonight in Madison. And if you are in Madison, you can also see Vivian's collages, which are part of their Chemistry Imagined project. They'll be on exhibition at the Union South Gallery on the UW-Madison campus. For details about all of it, visit our Facebook page, 45 North, on WPR, and you can join our conversation. What do you think about bringing science and art together? Are you a scientist who makes art, an artist who loves science? Where do you find the common ground between the two? You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or on Facebook, 45 North on WPR. You're listening to 45 North. We're talking about science or chemistry and art with Roald Hoffman and Vivian Torrance. I'm Ann Strain-Champs. This is 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. We have another caller, Jack, on the line from Delavan. Hi, Jack.
Hi, good morning. I want to thank all of you for a most delightful and stimulating conversation. I would like your guest to comment on this. It seems to me that both science and art reflect or at least demonstrate something that's summed up in this phrase, an infinite unity expressed in an infinite diversity. And it seems to me that they both sort of reflect or demonstrate that reality.
Yeah, what a beautiful phrase. Yes. Okay, let's see what they have to say.
It is a nice phrase, and it calls up, in my mind, the variety of molecules that we have, which are sufficient to make a body run and all the actions that we have in a human body or another organism, and also the infinite diversity of properties that one gets. Colors are one thing that comes to mind, but also things like electrical conductivity and other things. I just love that diversity.
But it's trying to find the unity. Vivian, I wanted to talk about some of the images and essays, sort of topics that you two have picked up in your Chemistry Imagined project. Is there one essay painting combination you could tell us about?
Well, if I can say a little bit how it started. When Roald and I decided to begin the collaboration, we had to figure out what it was that chemistry was about. We were trying to describe chemistry. And what does that mean? And he had all kinds of ideas, of course, about what we could talk about as themes. And I mm-hmm. was concerned about content. Being a fine artist, I wasn't going to start making pictures of different agricultural products. You know, I wanted to see them with a spiritual, mm-hmm. you know, what are the levels of reality that one wants to deal with? So we decided on 30, originally it was 20 themes rolled, and then you added 10 more at the last minute. But we did work on 30 themes, and that's what is in our book and 20 of those collages in the Union South Gallery. The one that I was thinking of to talk about is one called The Chemist. Like, who is he? What is he? He's represented as a figure from a 19th century engraving who often appears in natural philosophy books in experiment, doing experiments.
Mm-hmm. So and this guy in a suit.
There's a guy in this little, you know, like morning coat suit, little tux. And he has one hand out and he is looking at a tetrahedron that's split apart with things, a little kind of gemstone of some sort in the middle. To me, it represents what he is trying to, the simplification, what he's trying to look at in the science, how he's going to come to the simplification of that undescribable matter into a geometric solid, mm-hmm. something that gives him. And then in the upper area, there's this hand, the grand geometer, I would call him, people might call him God, but people see a spiritual level in the upper third, a tangible earthling level in the middle, and then at the bottom it becomes very abstract with platonic solids, cones, and cylinders in the bottom.
Hmm.
And it's all pieced together, puzzle-like.
So that's your artistic interpretation of what is a chemist.
The mental constructs that he has right. to make in order to mm-hmm. see the world. It's all about how a person sees the world. We both live in the same world, don't we, Roald? I mean,
yes.
You're more a city person. I'm a more country person.
But so then, Roald, what would you say then about, and that's a gigantic question, what is a chemist?
It is the simplest collage, I think, in there, isn't it?
It is a simple collage, and it has connections to other things. In doing this world, in dealing with this collage, I wrote the essay after I saw the collage, and what interested me was this fellow looking at this geometrical solid and trying to interpret it. And I thought, in fact, about something we've already discussed here, and that is reductionism, that we tend to simplify the world. I think the only thing simple in this world is our human mind. The world is complex. And chemists are no different from other people. They try to take things apart in order to understand them. That's been in science from the beginning. The interesting thing about chemistry is the world keeps reminding you that of its diversity, of its variety in those 70 million molecules. You take it apart and you see still other complexity. You can all the time try to simplify it. And it's very much like life. So I wrote a little essay about how to deal with simplicity and complexity in chemistry to go along with that collage.
Hmm. I want to get to a couple more calls. We've got Vicki on the line from Madison. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a daughter who graduated in zoology, got her bachelor's degree, and is now going to school in Nottingham, England, in biological photography and imaging to get her master's. And when she's very artistic. When she was looking for a program to go into, they were few and far between. And I'm just wondering if you'd address the fact that it's hard to get into a program like this.
Hmm. Vivian, did you have any thoughts?
Well, I'm not really, other than a casual photographer, but when I see the word zoology, it takes me back a long ways to college when I was a zoo major, which I adored, except the process of looking at one slide after another of a slice of a chicken egg at a certain point got boring. But when I see biological photography, the photography in science today, I find it is absolutely remarkable and dazzling. So no wonder it would attract a person to wanting to do that. It's would be a great field. I know nothing about the photography field.
But that's so interesting that you started out thinking of zoology and loving science, because Roald, in your earlier training, I think there was a point at which you thought about being an art historian, am
yes.
I right?
As a result of a core curriculum at Columbia in New York City, I was exposed to history of art course, and then I took another one, and it was about the Italian Renaissance art, and a wonderful period of confluence of spirit, philosophy, and art.
And science.
And
during
science,
that. I mean,
too. There was the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. Whether from medieval times, the building of cathedrals, but the invention of perspective and all these things. Anyway, I was drawn by a good teacher, the way that people are into thinking about going into possibly history of art. I would say my college career can be summarized by saying that I worked up enough courage to tell my parents I didn't want to be a doctor. But I didn't have enough courage to tell them I wanted to be a historian of art.
Well, I think my parents held their breath when I said I was switching from Zoe into art.
Those are great stories. We've got time for one last call. Renee in Madison. Hi, Renee.
Hi. I love this topic. I wanted to just add to that, deciding about a career. I am an artist, and when I was deciding at one point, well, if I couldn't make my living as an artist, what else could I do? And it just hit me like a lightning bolt that science would be the thing. To me, it was the same, only you're making something different. When I'm painting, I feel like I'm exploring and discovering as if I was a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And so science would be the same feeling of exploring and discovering and making something, creating. To me, the way you think about it and the feeling between art and science is exactly the same.
Oh, that's lovely. And, you know, that makes me think, I mean, art uses the metaphor of creativity.
Yes.
Science uses the metaphor of discovery. Why is that?
Well, I think that's not right. As Renee said, art is very much a process of discovery, and in science there is a great aspect of creation. It's not the only the creation of good ideas, the hypotheses that somehow good science, good experiment takes into reality. In chemistry, we make molecules that were not on Earth before. Now, as I said, we should worry about the uses to which they are put. But just the idea of making a molecule in a shape that molecules don't want to have, it's so interesting. We do this all the time.
And Vivian, is there discovery in art in addition to creativity?
Oh, yeah, and I think every artist is quite different, but you have a possibility of exploring nature in a very realistic way where you are actually looking at things very closely, accurately drawing them, or you are in a mode of self-discovery and you are deep into your own studio, your own work, and finding out just what comes out when you attack a canvas or a piece of paper.
So in the end, I guess it's curiosity drives you both.
It's curiosity. You want to know what's in there.
Yes.
What will happen next?
Yeah, what if?
And it's wonderful here that here I have been in science almost 50 years. I've published recently an article in a journal in which I first published 50 years ago. and yet when I open the next issue of that journal and I see a new molecule, it's still wonderful.
Thank you both so much. Roald Hoffman is the 1981 Nobel laureate in chemistry. He's also a poet and playwright. Vivian Torrence is an artist, and they are the co-authors of Chemistry Imagined, Reflections in Science. In Wisconsin, they are in Wisconsin this weekend for the Science Festival, and they'll be talking about their Chemistry Imagined project at the Wisconsin Science Festival tonight. For details about it, visit our Facebook page, 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. Don't forget to friend us while you're there. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Stay with us. There's more 45 North coming up here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.